Good morning, everyone.
I'm going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Judiciary Committee. And first thing we have on the agenda that we're going to do first, real quick, we're going to do possible measure introductions. We have two that are before us. Council, why don't you give us the numbers and
Chairman of the committee, they're LC-191 relating to crime, creates partial defense to certain sex offenses. LC-3387 relating to crime, creates partial defense to certain sex offenses committed by juveniles.
All right, so we've got two that are dealing potentially with the sexting issues.
That's correct.
Issues. All right.
We might go into work session.
Yeah, so we're going to go into work session on possible measures for introduction.
And Mr. Chair, I move LC-3387 dated 2/13/11 and LC-191 dated 2/3/11 be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Cruz moves LC-191 as well as LC-3387 as possible to be introduced as measures for the Senate Judiciary Committee. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And now we're going to go ahead and start our public hearings. Because we have Senator Starr here, we're going to start at the bottom to take that one, and then we'll come back and go back in order. So we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 522. Council.
Chairman of the committee, Senate Bill 522 comes from Senator Starr. It authorizes courts to terminate parental rights of parents convicted of rape with respect to a child who conceived the result of the rape. Prohibits a court from awarding custody of parenting time to that particular parent.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Bruce Starr, for the record, I'm Bruce Starr, Senator from Senate District 15 in Western Washington County. I'm here this morning to advocate on behalf of Senate Bill 522. This is a very simple bill. It does exactly what Mr. Taylor says it does. And it came to me, quite honestly, through an email from a constituent early last fall, who relayed a situation that I found to be quite incredible, to be honest with you, where you have a minor child, a minor who was sexually abused, a child is conceived out of that abuse, the abuser is penalized through court proceedings and sent off to prison for a period of time. The abuser then comes back after the incarceration and through DMV records finds the woman he abused and demands to have parenting time, demands to be part of this child's life. To me, that seems incredible. It seems like why would we allow that? To be honest with you, I was surprised that we didn't have statutes that already covered a situation like this. But apparently we did not or do not, and that's the genesis of this bill. I would ask that you consider the bill. I would ask that you move the bill forward so that young women, older women, women that are the victims of rape in whatever circumstance would not have to live the trauma over and over again by having a father demand the rights of a parent over a child that is conceived as a result of the crime. That's the extent of my testimony. Just based on the fact that we learned about the hearing late last week, I wasn't able to get others to hear to testify. But again, I think it's relatively simple. It's something that, to be honest with you, I was surprised that we hadn't taken care of in the statutes before. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd welcome any questions. But again, I would just ask that the bill be moved and we take care of this issue.
Okay, great. First of all, just for everyone that's here today, all of the bills that we have are public hearing. Senator Bonamici asked me a question regarding the bill, and so I'm going to ask her to put the question on the record, and not that you need to respond right now, but it's something that we probably just want to flesh out, make sure we are not going to have any unintended consequences. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Starr, for bringing this bill to our attention, this issue to our attention, and I applaud your intentions. I was looking at the applicability, and it's in the beginning, both in the termination and in the visitation part, it applies to ORS 163355, which is third-degree rape, which is having sex with someone under 16. And I just want to make sure that this isn't intended to apply to a situation where, like a statutory rape situation, where, in fact, a young woman and a young man may eventually at some point in their life have a relationship and want to have either the parental rights or the visitation. So I wouldn't mind if counsel looked into that to see if that's what you intended and whether that would be covered by this. And also I'd be interested in finding out, Mr. Chair and from counsel, how this type of situation is currently handled in the courts. Even if there isn't a statute, is it something that the judges would terminate the parental rights if they knew that the parent was convicted of rape? So, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Senator Starr, for bringing this to our attention.
Just to answer, I mean, the first issue you raised, I think, is an important one to distinguish, and I think we can flesh that out. The second one, I don't know the answer to, other than the story that was relayed to me in an email where the judge basically said, we're sorry, we don't have the authority to terminate parental rights or to preclude visitation. So again, it's probably worth having folks that work in this area come and visit with you as well.
Great. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First to Senator Bonamici, that's worth looking into, but there would also be an avenue of remedy. Let's say that did happen and they ended up together. You can always have a further petition sort of thing. But my question, Mr. Taylor, is Section 2, line 9 and 10, where it says, or other comparable law of another jurisdiction. What does that mean?
Chairman of the committee, that would mean the laws of the state of Washington, the laws of the state of California.
Okay, so this is just
comparable
connecting
jurisdiction. Fine, Mr. Chairman
okay.
of the committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, the underlying premise in all this is the best interest of the child.
Right.
That's a current standard now on that overlies this whole area. So,
all right. Any other questions, comments?
Thank
Senator
you,
Starr, thank you. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 522, and then we're going to go ahead and see if we've got the sheets on the other side. So we're going to go back to the top, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 43, and I'll go ahead and open up the public hearing. Counsel.
Chairman, it's coming to Senate Bill 43. Here from the Department of Justice, Support Enforcement Division, allows the state of Oregon to collect from a parent owing past due child support an amount equal to the last ordered monthly support order. If there's no ordered monthly support order, then the amount equal to the arrearages amount. Removes the 15% cap for collection of arrearages from unemployment benefits to increase the cap. Chairman of the committee, the intent of this bill is to increase collections, particularly in arrearages, and to make Oregon's laws similar to the laws of other states in this area.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have four individuals that are signed up to testify. I'll call the proponents up, and that's Gene Fogarty and Walt Bigelow.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We have a lot of Packers fans on the committee today, so we have good. Thumbs up around. Chair, I'm the director of the Oregon Child Support Program. And just to remind you and the committee members, this is a federally regulated program that's administered by the state. I'm the administrator of the program. It resides and is administered in the Department of Justice, but we also contract with 26 district attorneys that provide child support services to the families in Oregon as well. And Mr. Bigelow is here to talk to you about their perspective as part of the program on this bill. The child support program serves about 450,000 families in Oregon, regardless of income. So the bill that we are asking you to support has a great impact on the families in Oregon. I'd like to just give you three reasons why this bill helps Oregon. It'll increase collection of child support for the families that depend on this money to meet the basic needs of their children. It will level the playing field between Oregon and other states who compete against each other for federal funding based on performance. And thirdly, it would simplify the withholding rules for the thousands of employers in this state who collect child support through their payroll clerks. So going back over those three points, I'd just like to make a few specific facts for your consideration. When I said it would increase collections for families, specifically it would raise the amount that we could collect against lump sum payments that are received by obligated parents. Right now we are limited to 25% of that lump sum payment. So that might be a personal injury settlement, that may be a workers' comp claim, it may be a severance payment or another lump sum received by an employer. We are unaware of any other state in the country that limits collections for child support to 25% of the lump sum, these lump sum payments. Most other states have a 50% limit, which is what we're proposing here in Senate Bill 43, or they have no limit whatsoever. So if we can get to that 50%, like other states, most other states, we're going to be able to increase collections for families by conservatively about $2 million in a biennium. You know, that's a significant amount of money for families that are trying to raise their children in single-parent households. I also mentioned that Senate Bill 43 would level the playing field between Oregon and other states. And this is a really important point for your consideration. By lifting the cap on 25% and also lifting the requirement to leave the obligated parent with 160 times the federal minimum wage, we can compete with other states and also, and I think most importantly, get money to some of our lowest income custodial parents, particularly with the federal minimum wage limitation. These are the, by lifting this, we're going to be able to get money to low-income custodial parents who have really gone without the child support they were owed for years. These are cases that go into an arrears status. Child is 18 and there isn't any current support owed any longer, and it's an arrears case. But I don't think that that makes the money owed any less significant. This is a family who's had to rob Peter to pay Paul to continue to support those children. The custodial parent without the support owed by the non-custodial parent. So this is really payments that are deserving. It's an important IOU to these kids. By lifting the federal minimum wage restriction on these cases, there are still limits on what the state can collect, important limits that will mean that the non-custodial parent, the obligated parent, will continue to have money to live on themselves. Still be limited to the current support order and also be limited by the Consumer Credit Protection Act. So for most obligated parents, a change in the law here would mean that they would continue to pay against that debt, but they would be paying more than they are paying now, because the reality is that the federal minimum wage provision that we have now, really these cases go to zero payment or no payment, and that leaves the custodial family really with no recourse. Now, I know that Legal Aid has concerns about this provision. I've met with them. I believe that we can work out their concerns. I've looked at federal law. I think I have the authority to work on a hardship agreement with them. I've just reviewed quickly their written testimony this morning, and I would respectfully disagree with their analysis. But I do think we have the ability to work together to come up with some alternative language that would meet their concerns. On the few cases, in my opinion, that really would this really would work a hardship. My third point was that this bill simplifies withholding for employers. And, you know, at first blush, you might say, well, why is that important? And it really is significant. As I stated, 70% of the collections that we make for families are through employers, through income withholding. And our laws right now are very complicated and time-consuming for employers. Employers can withhold up to 50% on the lump sums that they pay to their employees if it's a current, if there's current support owed. If there isn't, then it's a 25% cap. The federal minimum wage, which of course is different than the Oregon minimum wage, requires another calculation. If they get income withholding orders, which they do from Washington, Idaho, California, different rules apply because we have unique Oregon limitations. So they have to understand and apply our rules and other states' rules. Many of our employers are multi-state. So again, they're also dealing with these unique limitations that Oregon has in those cases. I have a whole unit of people who do nothing but support our employers. And they report that they field hundreds of calls every quarter from employers who can't figure out all of these complicated rules that we have. So the simplification of withholding is very beneficial. It'll reduce errors and liability by employers. It'll reduce their staff time. And it'll reduce my staff time, state staff time, and assisting them in the application of these complicated rules. I'd also like to mention that we have an amendment pending on this bill. Nothing substantial here, no substantive change. It's just that we had neglected to include the PERS statute in the lump sum, 25%. So that is with legislative counsel. Am I right, Mr. Taylor? I believe so. It is with counsel. And thanks. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
All right. First, we'll hear from Walt.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, council. My name's Walt Beglaw. I'm the Marion County District Attorney, and I'm also the president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association this year. I'm here to extend my support on Senate Bill 43 on behalf of the Marion County District Attorney and on behalf of the District Attorneys of Oregon. Briefly, as we enter this legislative session, I'd like to premise my comments that the division of child support and the local child support programs are essential features in Oregon's economic stability and its recovery through this recession. I've long held these programs out, not only locally, as the foundation of financial health for family in Oregon. And there's an enduring collaboration between state division and these local programs. So that's one of the reasons I'm here. This Senate Bill 43 is a great first step this legislative session. And for me, it represents a rational expansion in Oregon's capacity to collect child support, one that aligns with national models in terms of its percentages, and one that really elevates, in my mind, our ability to remain competitive in an ever-competitive market nationally for these dollars and the federal incentive dollars that come with them. So I'm just here to lend a strong voice of support for Senate Bill 43 and all of its features. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions for either of our panel? Senator Wesley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment and a question. I am somewhat concerned for the obligors who have a subsequent family and who may you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. I mean, you're robbing the existing family to help pay the arrears for the previous family. I think that needs to be addressed. And the question is, can you, with this new structure, would you be able to take up to 50% of these lump sum payments to pay the arrears for a child who is no longer a dependent, who is no longer a dependent child, but whose child support had not been paid while they were a dependent child?
Chair and Senator Whitsitt, the two points that you raise is a concern about having a second family, and Just like to point out that having a second family is factored into the child support ordered amount itself. So we take into consideration the other dependents that an obligated parent may have in arriving at the reasonable child support amount. Secondly, the lump sum expansion to 50% would be for current support cases as well as cases that are only in arrears where the child is 18 or no longer in the custody of that parent. So the lump sum changes impact all cases, current as well as arrears. Hope that answers your question.
If the child is, say, 20 years old, no longer is a dependent, but those child support payments had not been made, you could still take up to 50% of a lump sum, say, workman's comp claim to pay that child who is no longer a dependent.
Chair and Senator Woodson, yes, that would be
true.
That money would go to the former custodial parent, not to the child.
I'm sorry?
That money that would be collected for the 20-year-old that you've, for example, would go to the custodial parent, not to the child.
So it wouldn't benefit the child at all. It would benefit the other parent.
Yeah, it would go to reimburse the other parent for raising the child without the child support that they were owed.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just want to comment. I was going to ask a question, but Ms. Fogarty sort of responded by saying she was going to work with legal aid or was willing to work with legal aid, because I just want to make sure that we're at that fine line of making sure that people still have enough to pay their rent and that sort of thing. We don't want to lead people out onto the streets, in which case they're even less likely to pay child support. So perhaps I'll wait till the legal aid testimony and see if you can work something out with that regard. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, just curious. As an employer who has dealt with you, and it's always rather painful, how is this going to make it better for me? Kind of walk me through that.
Okay. Chair Brzezinski and Senator Cruz, the proposals in Senate Bill 43 will simplify the many rules that employers like yourself have to figure out, and those payroll clerks that have the employee and the check, and how much do they have to withhold. How much do they withhold on ongoing support? How much do they withhold if it's an arrears case? How much do they withhold if it's a lump sum, a severance payment, a bonus, or a commission check? These would simplify the rules that they have to apply by eliminating the federal minimum wage calculation. Wouldn't be required any longer. There would be the 50% limitation on lump sums would be most likely the same rules that you'd be applying if you had a Washington order or a California order, or if you were a multi-state employer. So we're chipping away at the complexity of the rules that those payroll clerks and small businesses have to apply and the time they have to spend to figure out how much they have to send to us through our disbursement unit to get that money to families. So I know clearly from the people that work with employers in the Department of Justice that this would make a significant this would be a significant step forward for the employers.
Ms. Chair, I hope so. It's it's not that, you know, the impact isn't on us. It's money going out anyway, but but we don't look forward to getting the orders from you folks. So if we can make that a little less onerous, that would be very helpful.
Okay. Any other comments? If you all would step back, thank you. I know you're going to be here for the next bill, but we have a couple of people who also want to testify on 43. I'll go ahead and call up Matt Mendenhall and Sybil Hebb. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 43? Matt?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Minahan. I represent Dads America, an Oregon Association of Children's and Family Services here in Oregon. Both those organizations are not against child support. I've said that for a number of years, but we are for, you know, what is equitable and fair. And we just simply feel Senate Bill 43 goes too far. And the arrearage cases, in many of the times, are to families where the child is no longer a dependent, and the parent does have a current family with dependents. So, you know, we feel strongly against that not being equitable and fair. And the Division of Child Support might be a better reference for this, but I believe there's already a provision in Chapter 25, 25387. I'm not a lawyer, but I believe there's a provision that already allows them to go past that 25%, and you might want to get clarification on that. The lump sum, we're not so against the lump sum portion as much, as long as there would be provisions in there that would allow for when the lump sum is the only lump sum and it's a principal that needs to generate, you know, income and it's their only income. So certainly there's an opportunity for us to sit down with them and work through that, because we're not entirely against that portion. Again, we just feel... we feel this bill goes too far, and it's not needed, and it needs a little bit more work.
All right. Thank you. Sybil.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today, and I want to also voice some concern about the impact of Senate Bill 43 from the perspective of the impact that it would have on low-income obligors. As you know, the Law Center provides free legal assistance to low-income families, and as such, we represent individuals who may be obligors or who may be obligees. And in those individual cases, we work on behalf of our clients involved. On a policy perspective, we work on this issue because we're simply unable to meet the need of every individual who seeks help from us. So we don't have the resources to do that. So when we're looking at child support matters from a policy perspective, we try to balance the concerns that would be important to low-income obligees as well as low-income obligors, the people paying support. That's a hard balance. It's not an exact science. And it's a difficult thing to know exactly what the right answer is in all circumstances. And for those reasons, we've developed a set of priorities by which we try to analyze policy decisions related to child support. I have them outlined in my testimony. Our first priority is to ensure procedural fairness for all the parties involved. The second is to maximize the income in the household of the child where there is a minor child, except to the extent that that would reduce the income of the low-income obligor to such an extent that he or she is unable to meet the basic needs necessary to maintain a home, maintain cars so that you can get to work, to maintain your job, which you hopefully, you know, can use to pay your ongoing child support order. And so that's sort of the balance that we try to strike, and where and we try to preserve as a third priority the ability of low-income obligors to provide for themselves. And the fourth priority is just to maximize the income available to families when the sole creditor is the state. We do distinguish between cases where the creditor is a state versus a parent collecting support for a minor child that's currently in the home. That's how we try to look at these things. And in applying these priorities to this proposal, as we've explained to the Department of Justice, and I should note that I really appreciate that we've had the opportunity to sit down and talk with them, and we do very much appreciate the work that they do, and they play a vital role for families in collecting child support, establishing, enforcing, collecting child support throughout the state. But we do feel that this bill doesn't strike the right balance, and that the current law does a good job of trying to preserve the ability to collect dollars while also protecting low-income obligors' ability to meet their basic needs. I agree with Mr. Minahan that the two different proposals related to the ability to one portion related to the ability to withhold from monthly income and the other related to the ability to withhold from a lump sum payment, those can be distinguished. In my mind, the monthly income gets at the obligor's ability to meet basic needs on a continuing basis. And right now, we protect, under Oregon law, the obligor's ability to maintain federal minimum wage, $1,160. So someone making Oregon minimum wage would still be subject to withholding to a certain amount, down to the amount that is the federal minimum wage. Below that level, the obligation, where it's arrears only and there is no child living in the home, would not be collected. Doesn't go away. It just wouldn't be collected on that current basis. And we think that that's narrowly targeted such that it's protecting only the lowest of income people. By reducing that level, the ability to collect child support from people who have resources and substantial monthly income is not impacted one way or the other. But the ability to collect dollars from the lowest of income or obligors is significantly impacted. And just as an example, you could have someone making $800 a month in Social Security disability payments. Under the proposal, that payment could be $400 of that payment, that monthly income, could be removed. And we think that would have a significant impact on the person's ability to maintain housing, pay for food, et cetera. So that's sort of where our concern comes from. The lump sum payment withholding protections, I agree, we could be distinguished, and there are circumstances where I think we might be supportive of 100% withholding of lump sum payments. If it's a lottery payment and someone has substantial means to take care of their monthly needs, then maybe there's no need for a limit. But in circumstances where someone may have been injured on the job or applied for Social Security disability because they have an incapacity of some sort, often it takes a long time for those cases to get processed. Often those people are in a situation in which they don't have the ability to generate monthly income for themselves. And so that lump sum payment may be the only thing that they have, and it may need to provide their support for years to come. And so finding a way to distinguish within the lump sum payment arena between those obligors who are relying on that lump sum as a means to take care of their monthly, daily sustenance needs, and those for whom it is not serving that purpose, is something that we would be certainly willing to work on. And of course, we're willing to have any conversation at all, but our concern about changing the current income withholding protections, you could increase some hardship exemptions there, and that would make the bill less burdensome, but we continue to agree to believe that the current statutory structure is with respect to income withholding is the best balance. And so I appreciate the time today. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Questions for either of the panelists? All right, thank you very much. And before I close the public hearing, what I do want to, I guess, put on the record, I understand that the parties are going to continue to be working. What I heard through the questions and responses, I think we need a little bit more work on the application to arrearage cases. And also, the chair would like to know what is the practice in the bordering states to Oregon. And if you can give us an overview, I understand, you know, on a national level, too, that would be helpful, but specifically for the bordering states. Any other comments? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 43, and we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on Senate Bill 45.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 45 comes to you from the Department of Justice, standardizes at 30 days request for hearing in child support proceedings, removes the presumption of inability to pay child support from those receiving foster care payments, allows service of notice of the child support proceeding by mail service, allows trained division support staff to serve process, allows persons seeking limited support enforcement services such as accounting and disbursements assistance to complete a simpler application form that they don't otherwise have to do. Chairman of the committee, this is in many ways a housekeeping bill for the support enforcement division.
All right, thank you. I have three individuals that are signed up. Gene, why don't you come back, Walt and Sybil. And while they're getting situated, is there anyone else who will want to testify on Senate Bill 45? Gene, why don't you get us started? I assume this is going to be.
Thank you again, Chair Pozanski. This is really an efficiencies bill. I just want to explore with you, to me, the three key features of the bill. It simplifies the processes for child support legal actions, making the hearing responses consistent.
It avoids the cost of certified mail service by allowing documents to be served by mail with delivery confirmation. And it avoids significant costs of private process servers by allowing DOJ in-house investigators to serve child support documents outside of branch offices. Those are the three, to me, key pieces. There are also other technical issues that I'd be happy to address, but I'd like to direct your attention to these three features first. On the consistent hearing times, currently, there's a lot of different actions that go into the establishment of paternity, establishment of a support order, as well as enforcement and arrears establishment. Right now, our hearing times are 14 days, 20 days, 30 days, or 60 days, depending on the process. So what we're proposing here is to make it simpler for staff and make it simpler for the families that we serve, that we make those response times consistent to 30 days. This will increase the time to response and ask for a hearing or to object in the majority of cases. But as I said, there are a couple of 60-day response times that would go to 30. The Office of Administrative Hearings is in support of this provision. The second important provision is service by mail with delivery confirmation. This avenue that we're proposing as another way to serve and give notice to parents would only be applicable in cases where the party has confirmed their current address. But it is definitely faster and less expensive than certified mail. Certified mail is just not very effective. Oftentimes the wrong person signs, which means we have to redo the service. Or people just, they don't particularly care to sign for certified mail. They don't know what they're signing for. But if they've worked with the office and we have a current address, we can use mail delivery with confirmation and assure that they get notice for the proceedings. Thirdly, the service of legal documents by DOJ investigators. This is a great cost avoidance measure of about $500,000, we're estimating, over a biennium. Right now, I contract with a service, a process server, and we pay for each attempt of service. And so if they are not effective, they still get paid. This service rate is poor and it costs a lot of money. So having DOJ personnel who can currently serve process in branch offices, expand that to be able to go outside of our branch offices is really just good business sense. And we hope that you'll agree with us on that. The other changes are covered in my written testimony. They're more technical tweaks addressing some drafting errors and unintended consequences that we've discovered. There is also an amendment, again with legislative counsel, to add two statutes that we had missed to make them consistent with the 30-day hearing response time that we're proposing. And that's all I had to say to you, and I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name's Walt Beglaw, and I'm Marion County District Attorney and President of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Here to extend my support of Senate Bill 45 for both the DAs and for Marion County. Essentially, Senate Bill 45 makes essential adjustments in the child support arena. It's going to improve performance, makes us more competitive again, and there's no need to be shortchanging tax-paying citizens here and shortchanging our collective efforts, and I think this bill makes a very strong step forward in that arena, and we support them.
All right, thank you. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Civil Head of the Oregon Law Center. Again, here also to voice my support. We've had a chance to sit down with the Department of Justice and go over all the amendments, which we appreciate, and I think it's a good bill. I would just particularly note that the issue related to service of mail, service by mail with delivery confirmation, we do very much appreciate, and we see a lot of times certified mail is something that people are afraid of, and I think this is a practical way to get good, effective notice to folks, so thank you.
Questions?
Chairman of the Committee, Ms. Fogarty. When you use the term "or by any other mail service with delivery confirmation," my assumption is that's not email.
No.
Okay. What kind of mail would it be?
Well, I think my recollection of us using that language is to anticipate that there may be other products that the Postal Service will be making available in the future. The problem with this bill when it was written was certified mail. That's what we had. We didn't anticipate the fact that there really is there could be future innovations that we could want to take advantage of.
Thank you.
So let me just follow up on that. So it could not only be U.S. Postal Service, but maybe UPS or FedEx, somebody that has some type of letter delivery, but you're talking about something that would be handed or brought to a residence or a business address?
Yes, that's exactly right.
All right. The other thing I guess I want to put on the record regarding the confirmation of mail delivery, my understanding is it just confirms that whatever package is going, it gets to that location. It does not say the person that you're trying to get notice to actually received it. It only was received at the location. Is that correct?
Chair, that's correct. However, we would only use this once we have confirmed that that is the current address of the parent that is to receive the documents.
So what if it does get to the address where the everything's legit, but whoever receives it isn't that person, and for whatever reason you have a claim from the one that you're trying to get the notice of coming in and saying, hey, it may have been delivered here, but I never saw it and no one ever told me. Where, does that help us, or does that, or is that going to hinder us in trying to move forward?
Chair, if I just wanted to see if I could, let's see, confirm here. My recollection is that we're going to follow it up with first class mail. Page 3.
While you're looking at that, I mean, normally on first, when you do certified mail, that's normally what happens for certified mails. You also file a second one that goes U.S. first class postage, and the assumption is if even if the certified one's not picked up and the other one does not come back, is not deliverable, then there's a presumption that they actually received it.
Yes, Chair, the language requiring follow-up by first-class mail to the last known address is contained in the statute. So even with mail confirmation, we would be having that second check that that the documents were received.
Okay.
Just something, if I may, the only other thing I would add is that I think that under the current law, as well as under the proposed bill, if a person does not actually receive notice, they have the ability to raise that objection and make that showing. So this would not affect that in any way.
All right, thank you. Senator
Wissett. Yes, Chair, just a clarification on the oral agreement. I would assume that would be required to be stipulated by both parties.
Chair Pozanski and Senator Whitson, I think you may be referring to the next bill that's up, Senate Bill 445.
I am. Sorry.
Hold that question. They're not going too far away. All right. Is there any other questions or comments? And please keep your seat where you're at. But now I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 45. And I'll go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 445. And counsel?
Chair, Senate Bill 445 comes to you from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. Allows a court to consider a credit against child support arrearages where the obligee and obligor, usually the parents, have agreed either orally in writing to a payment of an amount at child support that is less than the amount ordered in the child support order. If reduction amount is reasonable or the child for whom the child support has been ordered died. Mr. Chairman of the Committee, this is in response to a Court of Appeals case, Hunt and Hunt, decided October 27th, 2010, where the court stated where the child had died, statutory construction prevented it from revisiting that order.
Yes, and we'll go ahead and let the department talk. I actually had another inquiry that came in on another bill, and I'm not sure if we had a second one that was filed for the same thing, but I know this resulted in what Brewer's decision was as to what the limitations. So, Gene, if you could give us maybe a little bit of background on that particular case as to what happened so that everyone can have kind of context, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator. Jean Fogarty, Director of the Oregon Child Support Program, Department of Justice. This is not our bill.
Okay.
In fact, we have significant concerns about the bill because, as written, it would take our program, the Oregon Child Support Program, out of compliance with federal law. I did have an opportunity to speak with Mr. Taylor about this and sent him some of the legal concerns that we have. I also have my general counsel, AAG, in the room with me if you want to go into more of the particulars, concerns about the problems with federal law and the other state statutes that it
I think before
into.
We go any further on that, what I want to do, and Sybil, I'm assuming, are you in the same position as the agency department?
I have concerns, yes.
All right, so I think we need to just kind of put on the record, and counsel, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I understand is that there was an obligation against a father and the child for one of that the obligation was for there. I guess there were two children that were involved, and there was a lump sum support payment obligation that was required. One of the children died, and then the parents orally modified the judgment as to the amount of child support that was supposed to be paid. And if I'm not mistaken, they were in agreement, and then something happened. I'm not sure what happened, but it caused this case to go up as to whether or not the parties had the ability to modify the existing court order on a verbal agreement. And when it went to the Court of Appeals, if I'm not mistaken, is where they said that the law did not provide for that, even though the parties were in agreement that the amount of child support should be reduced because there was only one child at that time. Is that
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's correct.
All right. So
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when I read it, one of the points I think that's worth stating here is that this parent was unrepresented up to the Court of Appeals level, and I think the court had some trouble figuring out the issues and the legal problems, because there really were remedies available to this family. There's an ability to satisfy a debt if the parents are in agreement. They could enter into a stipulated modification. There were several remedies available, unfortunately, that these parents did not take advantage of. So the case itself may point out an issue in some rare cases, but unfortunately, the parties were not represented at the Court of Appeals level, which I think led to probably spending a lot of time over something that could have been remedied very, very easily if, in fact, the parties were in agreement.
Okay. So why don't we go ahead and get your other perspectives on the record, and then we'll see where we're going to go from there.
Thank you, Chair. As I stated, as this is written, it takes us out of compliance with federal law that prohibits retroactive modifications of child support. We are looking at alternative language that could really be far more focused on an issue that could be presented here. When in Oregon we have unsegregated child support amounts, or class orders they're called, that the court referred to here. So when an obligation is set for two or three children, it isn't, they aren't individual orders. It's a class order. So when an event happens like the death of a child, a modification proceeding would take a look at the current income of the parents and the surviving children and determine what the child support order ought to be going forward. Sometimes that's the same amount, sometimes that's less, sometimes that's more, depending on the circumstances of the family. The bill as written doesn't really address those realities of how child support is calculated. It's kind of like, you know, hunting a mouse with an elephant gun. It goes way beyond what is necessary to address in terms of the issue presented in Hunt. We are willing to work with the proponents to come up with alternative language that would be fashioned in a more focused way. And I don't know that I know who the proponents are, but we'd be happy to work with them on it.
Thank you. Sybil?
Thank you, Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center. And I echo Ms. Fogarty's comments, would only add also that the provision related to oral agreements versus written agreements, and I think this may have been what Senator Whitsitt was asking about, does cause us some concern. So I don't know if that answers your question, but the oral agreements, it's hard to know whether they were made with information or without. It's hard to know, be accurate about what they were, and to know how they were agreed upon, and so that would be a concern as well.
All right. Counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm just reading from the case. The statute is explicit in actions for arrearages. The Court of Appeals Authority is limited to consideration of the amount of the arrearages. Ms. Fogarty, the question I have for you is, when a child dies, my assumption is the obligation to pay child support ends at that time.
If the child support, Chair and Mr. Taylor, yes, if the child support order is for only that child, that is true. It does extinguish with the child's death. In this case, there was a surviving sibling that was also the beneficiary of that order. And that's what makes it a little more complicated.
Further question, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. My assumption is that in that case, the parent would have the ability to go in and ask for modification, the child support order. But I take it what the court is saying, the Court of Appeals doesn't have the ability to do that.
Chair and Mr. Taylor, yes, that is what unfortunately the remedy, the avenues to address the issue were not taken by the family. They didn't contact my office. They didn't go to court. They didn't take any action on the agreement that is alleged to have occurred. So they didn't seek that remedy, no.
They had to do something to get it in the Court of Appeals.
Right.
So they had to go to court.
Yeah, what occurred was at some point, Mr. Hunt saw that he was being assessed the full amount of the child support. The collection actions were beginning. So he went to court, I believe, to petition on setting the arrears at the amount he believed to be the correct amount. And it was at that level, and it was a Lane County case, that the court at that lower level did give him credit. And I believe it was Mrs. Hunt who then appealed, and the Court of Appeals overturned the lower court's decision to grant the credit, saying there wasn't any authority to do so.
So in other words, it seems like maybe where there was supposedly a meeting of the minds, at some point there was no more meeting of the minds, and then we had the adversarial proceeding.
Chair, apparently so. Although it's not clear from the Court of Appeals case, it sounds like there's still an agreement. So I had a hard time deciding how it happened.
All right.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, you know, if they had an agreement, I mean, it just doesn't add up. If there's agreement, it never makes the appellate court. So, I think what would be beneficial here was if there's modification, a child dies, or if financial conditions change dramatically. I mean, I'm all in favor of if the two parties can reach agreement, that they can get a modification without having to lawyer up to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
which I assume they can do if they go through the procedure and process to make that desire known to the agents.
That's correct, Chair.
Yeah.
All right. So let me just throw a question out here, and I know there's probably going to have people scramble when I say this, but when you have these original orders entered, if they are bundled together for multiple kids, should we or should we not be asking the court to actually identify the amount that is being required for each of the children? Not that you wouldn't have a bundled amount, but some way that it's been determined by the trier of fact at the original determination as to what they feel is appropriate for each child. So would that be any benefit to this system?
Chair Pruszynski, I have to tell you that we're about to enter into another review of our child support guidelines, and this is one of the questions that I've raised for my policy folks and as well as all the lawyers in the community that are going to be coming forward as a question, should we be addressing how we structure our class child support orders in Oregon? Because there is some consequences to approaching child support in this way that can overly complicate our processes, and it's been our longstanding approach, but I think it's worth taking a look at.
All right.
Mr. Chair, it's got to be a little more complicated than that. I mean, you know, you enter into a judgment with three kids, and what the judgment may be may not necessarily meet the need, but meets the income ability, and so with a lump, then one kid is gone, it still may not meet the need, but still be within ability. So.
Yeah.
Right. Any other questions, comments?
So regarding the this review, when is that going to start? How long will it take for that review to be completed?
Chair Mazansky, it is a year-long process.
Okay.
Monthly meetings. We're getting the committee together now, and I've gotten a very good response from the private bar and the bench to be part of that process.
In other words, don't rush us. All right. I appreciate that. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 445? Not seeing anyone come forward or raising their hand, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 445. Council, what else do we need to cover before we adjourn?
Chair, members of the committee, I can't think of anything else.
All right.
Just the bills. We've come to the hearing, and all the bills will be before us.
Yep. So thank you very much for being here. We'll adjourn till tomorrow at 8:30, and we're adjourned.